This is EdUp Legal with your host, Deborah Solmore. She's an experienced higher education lawyer, most recently the general counsel for a system of nonprofit institutions, and she's going to be leading conversations about trending legal, regulatory, and compliance matters in higher education, with a focus on leaving out the legalese and making legal easy. Let's hear from your host, Deborah Solmore.
Welcome to another episode of EdUp Legal. Today, I am extremely excited to have as my guest, Jose Padilla, the current president of Valparaiso University. One of the reasons I really wanted to meet with Jose is because, like me, he spent part of his career as a general counsel of a university, and I have just sort of been fascinated by the transition. I think there are some people that think lawyers always have to be lawyers. And so to talk to somebody who has moved outside of that legal role into a presidency and an operational role is fascinating to me. So hopefully it'll be fascinating to you listening as well. So welcome, Jose.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm really looking forward to our discussion today.
So I have to just sort of, I know I disclosed this to you, but I have to say that I'm doubly excited to have you on the podcast because you sort of spent your GC role at DePaul University, where I attended law school. So as an alumni of DePaul, I still do a lot of work with the law school and the law school students. I'm a huge fan of the dean who sadly is leaving the institution, but a huge fan of Dean Jen. And I just love to get back and help mentor the law students. So talking to you is really just a treat for me for so many reasons.
Dean Jen is great. I was on her search committee when she got hired, and I worked very closely with her over the years.
So what I really want to talk to you about is your transition from your general counsel role to a presidency. I guess I won't offer my opinion, but do you think that that's something that's common? It's becoming more common?
It's becoming more common, albeit slowly. I would say roughly, you know, you have to distinguish between lawyers who are presidents who were, like, say, former law school deans, who I view basically as academics, versus presidents who were general counsels, who didn't grow up on the academic side. On that latter category, the ones who were general counsels, I would say there's roughly maybe 5 to 7 of us across the nation. But I think that's going to grow over time. I noticed that there seems to be less resistance to the idea that a general counsel can be a good president. So I see it evolving. I think the more of us get that, we break the doors open for others who follow us.
And so sort of from your experience, what are the reasons that people think, oh, that GCs can't make good presidents? And I think it's similar along the lines where you have many boards, where some boards say, oh, I would love to have a lawyer. A lawyer has critical thinking skills. A lawyer knows about risk. They would make great board members. And then you have other boards that say, one lawyer's enough. I don't need any more lawyers. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
I think, you know, unfortunately, there are too many lawyers and all general counsels who are, you know, so conservative that they can't look beyond the four corners of the law, making those decisions. And, you know, at DePaul, I used to say, we are not going to be an office of no, where good ideas go to die and where our clients want to avoid us. And because there's more than just, you know, obviously, as a general counsel, you're assessing and recommending risk tolerance to your client. And the client makes that ultimate decision on risk tolerance. But, you know, I think lawyers are equipped to be great presidents because of their, like the things you mentioned, critical thinking, scope, and all that. But I can understand why a lot of folks wouldn't want general counsels as presidents if they come from that mold where they're just so hemmed in by their own concern about risk that they can't stretch or push the envelope.
I thought I had heard all of those sort of lawyer jokes about, you know, the negativity of a legal department. And I heard one not that long ago where somebody said that the mantra in their organization was to, quote unquote, run that by legal. And what that really meant was do it so quickly that they don't actually have a chance to look at it. So yeah. I thought that was funny. But I think you're right. It's very difficult in this day and age, and I don't think you would have much success as a general counsel in this day and age if that is your approach. I mean, your job is to support the business, help it get where it needs to be. Being the voice of no, but let's do it this way, or no, what do they say? Not no, but it's yes and. So I think that that's really where we find ourselves now as general counsel.
What I told my
So
attorney,
tell me, no, go ahead, go ahead.
no, what I used to tell my lawyers that, listen, your job is to attach yourself to your client's hip and internalize their agenda. And if the first route to where they want to go is a no answer, it's incumbent upon you, not the client, on you to find an alternative pathway. And, after you've exhausted that review and it can't be done, okay, fine. But it's your job to see if there's alternative pathways.
So talk to me a little bit about the process to wanting to move to a presidency role or wanting to sort of be in leadership and operations of an institution.
Well,
Sort of where did that come from? Was it
I had a great president who I worked for, Father Dennis Holschneider. He was president at DePaul for about 13 years, and he was the one when I got hired. And he always gave me a lot of leeway, and he let me engage in conversations that from a strict that I really shouldn't have been a part of, but I was a member of his cabinet, and so he was open to me talking about things that went beyond my portfolio, and so I was able to grow in that way. And I also was able to work very closely with the board and got involved in policy decisions that weren't strictly legal. And so again, they nurtured that ability. And then me observing him, I kind of realized, I think I can do this. And, ultimately the reason I wanted to do this is because I wanted to work with students. I wanted to be, at DePaul, we used to call ourselves the great equalizer for those students who needed that hand up. And I wanted to work at that kind of faith-based institution that was open, like DePaul was, wasn't exclusionary, wasn't rigid, but was something that basically worked with people who needed that hand up, who needed that great equalizer. And so for all those reasons, it just came to me that I would like to be a president.
And so you're a little over, what, 3 years into your tenure now?
It'll be 3 years, January 1st.
Okay.
So, yes.
So wow, so you took over right before COVID, right before the start of COVID.
No, it was in the thick of COVID. COVID had started in the, so I started January 1,
Oh, you
2000.
started in January of 2021. Yeah.
It was a little, I actually started part-time for January and February, actually came here on campus on March 1st because I was transitioning from being the general counsel of the University of Colorado System in Denver. So I ended that tenure right before Christmas of 20. And then as I told Valpo, I needed some time to transition to help the move and all that. But, so formally was here on campus on March of 21, but was actually in the thick of it remotely for those 2 months of January and February.
That could be a whole entire podcast episode in and of itself. So I'm sure you had expectations of what, maybe the president's role was going to be like. How much did what you sort of found when you started align with those expectations? And where did you sort of find challenges that you might not have anticipated?
Well, a lot of it was the things I had seen at DePaul, University of Colorado System, as well as Illinois Institute of Technology, where I started my career in legal education in higher education. So a lot of it didn't surprise me. There's always the tension between the administration and faculty, some of it good, most of it good tension. But remember, again, you're working in a cons in an area of shared governance where, it's I don't want to bottom line is you're all rowing hopefully in the same direction, but sometimes you can get off track and it's your job to kind of bring it back on track. So a lot of that I had seen already. I think the thing that I didn't expect wasn't so much the institution itself. Was the fact that as a tuition dependent private institution, the headwinds for enrollment were so hard, were so vigorous, and they continue to plague small independent private education. We have 29 private institutions in Indiana, and all of them are just leaning into headwinds where the demographics indicate there are just less kids to enroll. And you've got, therefore, to be a lot more cunning and scrappy to bring in your classes. And that's the one thing I, you know, once COVID started to abate, you kind of thought, okay, everything will go back to more normal. It's not the case. So that's the main challenge that I didn't expect.
And how are you help navigating that challenge as in the president's role?
Well, you know, to be quite honest, I had hired somebody as the first vice president of enrollment management for me. And within a year, he left because it was tough. And I can't really explain his complete mindset. But then bottom line is he left. Fortunately, he gave us a couple months notice. And so I was able to hire a new vice president, woman from Loyola, Jill Scherer, who was actually an alum. And she's great. She's a ball of fire. But, you know, I don't expect her to turn things around overnight. So it may take some time. But another thing we did is we hired a really good consultant by the name of Human Capital, which is out of Evanston, Illinois. And they really help us understand the challenges we have on enrollment and kind of gave us a very realistic splash in the face of what's going on. Because a lot of times what happens, you know, people think, well, okay, build it and they will come. That's not the case. You've really got to be analytical. You really have to make your decisions based on data. And that data may basically kind of destroy the assumptions that you have. And then if that's the case, then you just pivot to plan B. So I think it's one, getting individuals who know the industry. And with Human Capital, they had somebody who worked with me at DePaul for my 15 years, who was the senior vice president for enrollment management. And he was somebody who I could trust, and I trusted his judgment. So that was very helpful.
Maybe I'm biased because I am a higher education lawyer, or I've spent at least a decade in higher education, but I would say that, you know, your sort of role as having been a legal advisor is probably very helpful right now, where the Department of Education, I feel like every few weeks they come out with a new set of rules. You know, they have rulemaking packages. They're really detailed. There's a lot of requirements there. And I think it probably helps being able to sort of understand them and see them in a different way than I think, you know, presidents without that background do, because some of them, you know, particularly the package that just came out in October that goes into effect in July applies to everyone. It's sort of not focused on for-profits this time. It applies to everyone equally. And there's a lot in there. I know we've done a couple podcast episodes about it, but, you know, sort of talk a little bit about how you're using your background as a lawyer to help you succeed and for the benefit of the institution.
I think the main thing that it helps me with is looking at it in perspective. I mean, if you weren't a lawyer, you see this, you just might be overwhelmed and figure, you know, what's the use? Having seen similar packages like this over the course of my career, and also, I think also what helped me was outside of higher education, I was in the Clinton administration. I worked in Washington, D.C. for 7 or 8 years. And so I know government bureaucrats, and I know what their capacity is and what their capacity isn't. So having all of that kind of, as opposed to me just like throwing up my hands and saying, forget it, I just kind of take it into perspective and realizing, okay, this is what we have to prepare for. This is what I won't ever stay up at night for, but, you know, I can be cool, calm, and measured for this. On this one, I may get my blood pressure up a little bit. And for those few instances, it's like, holy hell, I need some help. But that's very rare. So I basically, when those kind of packages come out, I take it with a certain grain of salt. I take it seriously, but I also don't let it like freeze me. And I think that's because of my legal background.
And I think that that's probably very helpful to your cabinet, your administration, and your board, because I know that, you know, after I did the I think I've done two episodes on the most recent ones. I've had people that have reached out to me and said, oh gosh, I didn't realize that that there was all this out there. You know, how do I help prepare for that? I sometimes think, oh, if I was an outside lawyer, that'd be a great thing because there's some new clients, but you know, that's not my role anymore. What is your relationship? I'm very curious to sort of say, what is your relationship now or your perspective now on the legal team you work with at Valpo compared to sort of you being the client now, as opposed to being the general counsel?
It's a little different because remember at DePaul, I had seven outstanding lawyers work for me. And I'll be honest with you, at DePaul, it got to the point where I didn't practice law anymore. My job was to supervise them and serve the president and the board on policy issues, on communication/crisis issues. It got to the point where I loved crises because that's where everything I had been trained to do just could kick in. As I used to say, I love me a good crisis. But here I have an outstanding general counsel, but he's it. And, you know,
so a department of one.
A department of one. I used to have a second lawyer, but before I came because of budget cuts, he lost that person. So he's a great lawyer who has to, you know, where at DePaul, I could throw two lawyers at an issue, or three lawyers at an issue. I'm just throwing one lawyer at an issue, right? And he may need some outside legal help if it's beyond his bandwidth because he's juggling a lot of things. But so it's me also understanding that, listen, because he's been a solo shop virtually for all those, I think he's been here 12 years, he has a good sense of risk tolerance and what he has to pay attention to and what he can let go. And so that's one thing I have had to adapt to, but I trust his judgment. But what's good about my background, I don't micromanage. I really try not to micromanage. It's tough sometimes, particularly when I've been in his role. But what's good about it, if there's a legal issue, a really pressing legal issue, I just don't leave my legal background on, you know, off the table. I can use that as well. And so then we have two lawyers working on an issue.
That's interesting. In my prior role, which I had been at for 5 years, I was a GC and I had a team of 8 people, including my admin. And in my new role where I've been here at Gateway for, I don't know, 36 days, I'm building the in-house counsel function from the ground up. So I am the sole lawyer. So to your point, I'm not used to not having somebody to bounce something off of or talk to and sort of having to try and guide our CEO and our leadership team as one person. And sound confident and sound, you know, like I know what I'm doing is very different. So bear with him.
No, he's great. And, you know, one of the things I really strive not to do is to second guess him. And in fact, to be honest with you, there's only been a few instances where I really kind of intervened because I had a special background. For example, on unionization. I'm not going to go into the detail, but there was a unionization, an attempted unionization effort at DePaul. And we were able to avoid that because I was given the task of leading the effort to dissuade folks from doing that and showing that there was nothing gained by being unionized. And we were successful in that regard. So I had a particular background there that my general counsel doesn't have. So there I can, that's one of those examples where I can kind of lend my experience to him for his benefit because he hadn't seen that kind of thing.
We were talking before and you said sort of using your kind of legal background, you can figure out these are the things I breathe about. These are the things I pause on. And these are the things that, you know, I think you said, you know, holy heck, I need some help. So right now, what's sort of keeping you up at night in the higher education space? I mean, there continues to be challenges every year, the wrap up for the year end and, you know, any articles about what's coming next year. You know, many of them are not positive, is particularly to your point about small private institutions. So what's really on your radar screen other than enrollment management?
Well, nothing actually keeps me up at night because ice courses through my veins. But at least that's what the image I want to project.
Okay, fair enough.
One, it continues to be enrollment, but we're doing a program review here at Valpo, which is a lot of schools are doing, because, you know, we're smaller than we used to be. And we have some very good people in our data shop, but there's just not enough of them. And we have data being collected in a different bunch of different ways, but not terribly centralized or coordinated enough. So we have somebody working with us on that, because we have to figure out, based on our smaller size, you know, for example, we have 70 majors, and I would say maybe almost half of them only have a couple students in those programs. And, you know, the question is that a right thing to continue to do? Is it the right expenditure of resources for that? You know, given that we're smaller, can we continue to be all things to all people? Probably not. And I know for a fact there are other similarly situated institutions who are going through the same exercise, because all of them are being affected by this demographic crunch that we're facing. And you have to make these tough judgments. So this is a challenge that we're starting to get the findings from an outside contributor, and we'll be going through those and then figuring out what's the best path forward on both the academic side as well as the operational side. And in so doing, you know, we may be making tough decisions on, do we continue to offer 70 majors, 70 minors, maybe even more minors, and that type of thing.
Very interesting. I guess I would love to continue chatting with you all day long, but respectful of your time, I guess two questions I'd close out with. Number one is, what is your most favorite thing about being president? So you sort of saw this role as something that you wanted to try and move towards. Now you've been doing it for almost 3 years. What's your most favorite part about the role?
Two things. One is, of course, the kids. Fortunately, I live smack dab in the middle of campus. That the last president who lived on campus was probably almost maybe 30, 40 years ago. So I'm right in the middle of campus, so I can interact with the students all the time. One of my favorite things to do is to go over to the student union, which is only like 3-minute walk from my house, with my dog Coach. And we probably are breaking some public health laws, but I take him into the cafeteria at lunchtime and he's off leash and the kids love him. And I just go out there and shoot the breeze with the kids. And as part of that kid issue is, you know, I'm always a firm believer in the underdog. I love seeing those new freshmen who walk campus with these oversized backpacks where the point they're like laborers, you know, being weighed down. They're afraid of their shadow. Sometimes they pass me, they won't look up. They know who I am, but they won't look up. And so these kids who are afraid of their shadow, but by the time they're seniors, they cast a wide shadow themselves. Mm-hmm. So I love seeing those underdogs grow into something of would become forces among themselves. I love going to the sporting events. The football stadium is a 2-minute walk from me, and I don't sit in the bleachers. I stand on the sidelines, and I go to the games, and I do the same thing on basketball and volleyball and all that. But it is ultimately this concept of being the great equalizer. We are trying to pursue being an Hispanic serving institution. And we've also created a 2-year college called the Access College, which is in its first year. And we have 25 students. And these are students who really couldn't get into the 4-year program, but we wanted to provide them with an alternative pathway to higher education. So effectively they can earn a 2-year associate's degree. If they can use that as a path into the 4-year program, if they choose, or if they choose to stop at 2 years, we're going to provide them with the best 2-year education they can get in order, again, to give them alternative pathway to a career or possibly an education if they go into the 4-year program. So I love being that great equalizer, or trying to be that great equalizer. We're offering these alternatives to students who, you know, higher education isn't an assumption from their family. Most of these kids are first generation. And I love it when they come here. And even though, again, they may struggle a little bit because they may not have had the family structure, or, you know, a family that where, you know, both parents are have degrees or professionals. These are kids who are looking to us, though, to help them take that step up. And that's the favorite part of what I'm doing.
And I know we chatted a little bit before we started recording that, you know, my higher ed journey really has been in sort of some of that non-traditional education. And that is something I'm so passionate about, that we need to be building out alternatives for those people that really are not, you know, destined from birth for your traditional sort of four-year education. So I think it's wonderful to sort of see you being passionate about that. Last question would be, for anybody who's thinking about how do I transition from sort of maybe not necessarily the GC role, but from the legal role, how do I use my legal education and my legal skills and my passion to transition into more of an operational role? Because I think you're very fortunate that, you know, the institution saw that as a plus. I think sometimes we feel as lawyers that people are looking at us like we talked earlier, and it's not necessarily a plus. You're a lawyer. You know, what advice would you have for people that are sort of looking to trying to want to transition into more operational roles in higher ed?
You have to get, you have to see the law as a separate tool that is in your toolkit. When needed, you can bring out that tool. But if you want to be a president or somebody in the operational side, you may have to leave that tool in the toolkit and develop other tools, and where you can get a more expansive view of what you have to do. You know, I think one of the, it started with me at my law school, the University of Michigan Law School, where, you know, they called it a so-called policy school. And so, you know, it's not only understanding what the law says, but why the law is the way it is. And that helped. Being in Washington helped me. When I was in Washington, even though my first job, it required me to be a lawyer, but it was basically advising on legislation. That helped me understand why the law is the way it is. And when I was in the Clinton administration, I managed a shop of 35 people, and it taught me how to lead people. So, and then, you know, as I was going through my journey in private higher education, you know, I was on boards. I was the chairman of the board of NACUA. And, you know, that helped a lot in terms of leadership and so forth. Why do I bring all this up? I think if somebody wants to go and make that switch, you have to start exercising that leadership muscle. And the way you do it is you get on boards, or you look at other opportunities where you're not just a lawyer. The lawyer is like the law is a force multiplier, but it's not the exclusive tool that you're using here. And you're developing other senses and instincts that will help you make that transition. And so at times I went to the last NACUA conference, which was in Chicago. I spoke to a group of lawyers making the transition or trying to. And the one thing I said, it sounds stupid, but get it on boards and start exercising that leadership muscle, or basically a muscle that you're expanding your horizons more so than the law. So it doesn't get into the way.
That's very great advice. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to come talk to me. This is just sort of a subject that's been noodling around in my brain for a while now. And so I'm very, you know, fortunate to be able to chat with you. I wish you a very happy holidays. And thanks again for coming on the podcast. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much. And I, like you say, go Blue Demons. I still have a soft spot for DePaul University. It kind of, I would say that was the main transition point where I changed from being just a lawyer to somebody who could be a president.
Yeah, I will share that in my new role, my office is literally across the street from the law school. And so I have not been back in this part of the Chicago Loop area in years. So every morning when I walk from the train to my office, I walk past the Barnes & Noble, I walk past the DePaul Law School. And so, you know, as I get up to speed here, I'm thinking it would be great to have a DePaul law student as an intern. So that's something to come. But in any event, all right, well, thank you. I really appreciate your time. And again, happy holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays to you. And it was great meeting you, Deborah.